welcome to a very special bonus episode of Rockets. As you know, if you're listening to this, you are probably a Relay FM member. You've done that special thing, and it is your month. It is August. It is all about you, and you are getting special bonus episodes of some of the shows on Relay FM. And this is ours. This is our show. I'm Simone de Rochefort. I am a senior video producer at Polygon.com. And I'm
worse
here
than Ken
Lay.
You're wow. Worse than Ken Lay, just for the record. Okay.
And I was born in the year 1990.
Okay.
I'm here with Brianna Wu, Democratic candidate for Congress, and Christina Warren, senior cloud developer senior cloud advocate at Microsoft. I remembered.
You remembered. Yeah, I forget sometimes too. It's fine.
Well,
I do cloud things.
I'm young.
I advocate.
I'm younger than you are, so I'm quite good still at remembering things.
As Brianna said, you were worse than Ken Lay. So
yeah. I mean, he embezzled he stole billions of dollars in people's life savings and stole their pensions. But you were born in 1990, which makes you the real villain of today's
It really does. And for any of our listeners who were born after Simone, you're fine. You're not on the show, rolling this, rubbing this in our faces that we're old.
Come on.
So you're fine.
Yeah.
Come on. They're out there making TikToks and,
yes. And that entertains me.
That's fair.
They entertain
right.
me.
So if I were on TikTok, but that's for later. Maybe you have gathered by now, listeners, if you're familiar with Rocket, which is a tech podcast, we often
is
will.
Is it really though?
Well,
is it
okay.
really?
It's about tech. It's about current events and the intersection of technology and security and politics. And occasionally it is also about scams, because we have a segment. Our last segment every episode is our dessert segment. And maybe it's about a pop culture thing that we love, or maybe it's about a wealthy scammer who has ruined lives. And we're endlessly fascinated by that. So
we love the scammers. I mean, sometimes
we
hate them.
We love to hate the scammers.
Well, unless they're Anna Delvey, in which case I think we just love them.
In which case, Christina Warren specifically loves them. So for today,
I know that's risky for me to say as someone running for Congress, but I too love her.
Yep. And thankfully, again, Relay FM members, you signed that NDA when you signed up for membership. So listen, for today's special bonus episode, we are doing Scamtown. We're doing our Scamtown shtick, and we're going to talk about something that, again, happened when I was 11 years old, and that is Enron. And I'm going to throw it to Christina to give us some background.
I'm so excited about this. So when we were trying to decide what scam to cover, there are so many that you can go into, and we have obviously on our show spent an inordinate amount of time talking about Theranos, because that is the most recent tech kind of scam, even though it's biotech and there's other aspects that go into it. And Elizabeth Holmes, and we've talked about other scams, but for me, and I think part of this is because unlike Simone, I was 17 / 18, I guess, when this happened. Enron, for me specifically, is the greatest of all time, the GOAT, if you will. But even historically, if we look at modern financial scams or modern kind of scams in general, some people would say, the financial collapse in 2008. Some people would say Bernie Madoff. And I disagree. I think that the greatest of all time, and honestly, the one that's the most audacious in so many ways, because Bernie Madoff is audacious, but it's basically a really complicated Ponzi scheme. Enron, to me, is amazing. So Enron was Enron, for people who don't know, was an energy company based in Houston, and they sold gas. So whereas most energy companies sell oil and are really involved in that, they were in the gas trade. And gas has always been kind of seen as the redheaded, stepchild in the energy business. And the collapse of Enron, which at one point was one of the most valuable companies in America, it didn't just take down Enron, which in and of itself, the fact that between April of 2001, when one of the first articles was written kind of questioning how are they making their money, to the CEO stepping down in August, to October, where the company, December, when the company filed for bankruptcy and was basically dissolved, you're talking about a very high-flying company, and within 6 months, it is gone.
Oh, my God.
But not only did Enron, which again was like a multi-billion dollar company, like it was at one point, like it had $63.4 billion in assets, which at the time made it the largest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history, and it was one of the, you know, considered one of the biggest, you know, kind of U.S. companies. It had at one point its stock was $90.75 a share, and then it plummeted it to less than a dollar. And it didn't just take down Enron and as Bree alluded to, you know, people's pensions and investors and all the many, many, many employees who had nothing to do with the fraud. It also took down Arthur Andersen, which was at the time one of the big five accounting firms and probably the most respected and one of the most storied firms. If you're familiar now with the company Accenture, which is a kind of a consulting services firm, Accenture basically was what was left of Arthur Andersen that they rebranded under another name. So the Enron thing, the reason to me it is the GOAT is because it didn't just take down one company, it took down two, including like legit the most storied and like well-respected accounting firm. It's kind of spectacular. It also
nearly took down the Bush administration. This was a huge scandal during the Bush administration because he was so close with Ken Lay. And not just George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., like both of them.
Yeah, it was really George Bush Sr. he was closest with. Apparently, yep. He didn't donate enough to George Jr. But you're right. The crazy thing with that is I think that, and we should put this into context, because if you didn't know about Enron or if some of it kind of got past you, a lot of the timing on it was really a big part of it too. So the collapse happened in the fall of 2001. So Jeff
Wait,
Skilling,
was this pre or post 9/11?
Genuinely like at the exact same time.
Holy crap.
So
it was a busy week. It was a busy month.
So Jeff Skilling, who had been the CEO, steps down in August. Okay. And then September 11th happens. And the markets, there has been kind of an argument. Obviously there was a ton of fraud going on, and we're going to talk about it. But part of what precipitated all of this was that the economy, which already in the stock market, which were already dealing with things coming off of the dot-com bust and whatnot, September 11th happened and had a massive impact on banks and financing and the market in general. And Enron, you couldn't have picked a worse time for this type of bankruptcy to happen. And I think that's why it moved so quickly. I also think that's why, unless, like, I was in college, I was a finance double major, and I was when the court stuff was happening, and that's when I really learned about it. But if I am being honest, you know, I was about to go to college when the collapse really started, and then September 11th happened, like, 2 weeks into college, and I was, like, not paying attention to this Houston energy company. And I think that's probably what a lot of people were. And then it was later on when more of these details came out, people went, wait a minute, what? So.
Yeah, I think when I remember that time, I definitely remember. So again, I was born in the year 1990, and that's why the purpose of this podcast episode is also to kind of teach me about some of the things that were happening. I was 11 years old. And I do have memories of just hearing the name Enron in the news and knowing that it was a scam, knowing that like there had been fraud and that people had lost money, but not really understanding what that meant. Not understanding what fraud meant, but not understanding what Enron had done, or really what their importance was. And then, of course, there was 9/11, and my only memory of that was just standing around with people at my small private school and being like, huh, whoa, what happened here? So this happened all around the same time, and both involved the Bush administration. So that was a very busy year for them.
So can I back up and give just a little bit of background on Ken Lay and
what was his deal?
Sure. So Ken Lay was the CEO and founder. Yeah,
he was the CEO. He's a really interesting guy. You know, he's somebody that came from true abject poverty. I mean, really, really, really being dirt poor. He went to college and, you know, his whole mission was to kind of not end up like his parents were. Like that the memory of being poor really haunted him for his whole life. And one of his biggest traits, according to the book on this, The Smartest Guys on the Room, which is excellent. I cannot recommend it strongly enough, is he really never wanted to upset people. He had a mission and a leadership style to be as liked whenever possible and wouldn't take hard lines on anything, which, you know, yeah, Weasley leadership, but also when there was fraud all around him, this really came back to bite him because there was no one steering the ship to kind of control this. So yeah. Enron, I'll kind of gloss over their whole history. Long story short, they really got big and Ken Lay became CEO when they had a merger with another company basically doing energy exploration. And they're like, no, don't worry. We're not going to relocate to Texas. You can trust us. We're going to be fine. And, you know, it just all ended up being a complete lie. They moved. And the thing that was really a bellwether for knowing something was deeply wrong at Enron was, you've got to understand, this was a company that was kind of conglomerated in 1985. And it took a long time to start raising money. And through the 90s, something happened that really should have been a warning klaxon for anyone watching Enron. There was only one division of the company that was making money. It was kind of doing these speculative investments in energy. It was natural gas specifically, wasn't it,
yes.
Christina? Yeah.
Exactly.
So they were
they would basically make a bet on what the price of gas would be. Was going to be and try to sign contracts to that point in the future with the idea that the price is either going to go up or down like any other sort of commodities trading.
Right. So they made, basically there's only one part of Enron that is making money. And the people at Enron that are kind of doing oversight, they're looking at this one section of it and they're going like, and it's worth saying, like, this is the least sexy part of the energy industry for most people. They're a lot more interested in speculation, locating oil, building drills, all of that. This is essentially a banking transaction. So it's like an afterthought at Enron. It's just making tons of money. And you've got people on the outside going, this doesn't seem like this could be legal. And eventually this all comes before Ken Lay. And you found out that even though, you know, Enron's books are apparently strong, this division had been cooking the books behind the scenes, lying to investors, lying to the public about how much they were making, what their risk was, to the point that in order for them to cover their own butt, Enron ended up like firing this guy immediately, throwing him out of the building. He ended up going to jail for a year. He went to prison. And then Enron brings in another guy to not tell the public about it so they can kind of get out of all these crooked deals, not tell the market, and basically offset the risk with some really shady accounting stuff.
Oh,
and they managed to
God.
Get out of it by the skin of their teeth. This is all before the collapse of Enron.
Yeah, that was like the late 80s, the Enron energy scandal. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing, is that this was a company that there are not clean hands, at least with some people like to say Ken Lay, who was, you know, he was the CEO and he was the leader and kind of the public face for the company. He tried to kind of argue, and we should note that he died after he was convicted in the fraud charges and was going to be sentenced to prison. But because he died before that happened, his record gets to be clean. But he and his, you know, his kind of argument against his co-defendant, who was Jeff Skilling, who was the president and later briefly the CEO of the company, you know, Ken Lay tried to be like, oh, I didn't know this stuff was happening. You know, like, I had such a big company. I wasn't aware that these things were happening. I let Jeff and Andy and other people take care of that. I didn't know. But when you go back and you look at that Enron energy scandal, you see he might not have directly been giving people the orders, yes, do this, no, don't do this, but he was completely complicit, 1,000% in doing everything he could to keep the illusions of the company being what it was and letting them get out of scams.
This kind of reminds me of a plot line in Succession season 1. Have you guys watched that yet?
Yeah.
I haven't.
Okay,
I haven't.
So it reminds me of when a particular character takes over the cruise ship division. He's kind of given access to this folder of evidence, basically showing that there have been a lot of shady things happening in cruise ships that have been covered up with foreign police departments and payoffs and stuff. And he takes it, he goes to the CEO and is like, you know, I've learned some things. And the CEO immediately goes, hang on, you know, my dad, who was previously running the company, really appreciates people who take care of things for him. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And the guy's like, okay, yep, gotcha. So that same situation where it's like, you know, there's something going on, but there's a sort of forced plausible deniability of like, oh, but yep. I didn't know about it.
Yeah. Although in this case, there were times when it was explicit where people told him. For instance, with that Enron Energy scandal that Bree talked about that happened in the late 80s, there were people who said that he was like very explicitly told what happened. And they the way they handled that was, again, to have a massive cover-up. And they got out of it by the skin of their teeth. Yep. But it was one of those things that when the company went public and started doing really well and was, you know, hitting all these marks, everybody just kind of ignored. And there are a couple of levels of the scam here. So the main thing here, most people kind of remember Enron, if they remember it at all, on the accounting side, was that they were using a form of accounting called mark-to-market accounting.
Yep.
And the use of that, it's not wrong in all cases, but it was certainly weird and obviously wrong to be used here. And so the idea of mark-to-market is that you are able to capture the assets for, let's say, a long-term deal on your books the moment that you make it, rather than having to wait for it to play out over, say, an extended period of time. Now, so that means that if I book a deal, let's say, Simone, that you agree to give me $20 million over 10 years.
Sure.
And I can, the day that we sign it, I can credit that $20 million as an asset and as revenue the day that we get it.
Now, so even if I've only given you $1, you're telling the books, hey, I have $20 million.
Exactly. Now,
well, and telling the public that, more important.
Right. Right, because it's part of your filings, right? It's part of your financial filings. So that's part of your earnings reports. Now, what you're supposed to do with mark-to-market is you are supposed to say, okay, if the value of those assets goes up or down, I'm supposed to make modifications to that over time, and I'm supposed to keep up to date with what those things are. But it is a way for people to realize the value of something when it happens, and that also means that your taxes, your liabilities, maybe your bonuses for, you know, your employees, all those things can be realized that way. And so this was a huge thing that Jeff Skilling, who he had been a partner at McKinsey, which is the best, you know, kind of consulting firm, very smart guy. He had actually been a McKinsey consultant to Enron and then jumped from McKinsey to Enron, which a lot of people thought was weird because he had been one of the fastest. Like, he made partner at McKinsey faster than the only person who'd made it faster than him went on to become the CEO of IBM. And you know, so he goes to Enron and he's kind of given control over this trading organization. This is after the first trading scandal. And he says he like makes it part of his mission, like going in. He's like, I have to use mark-to-market accounting. If you don't let me use it, I will walk. And they're like,
Can I say a word or two about him? Because he's one of the most interesting figures of this whole thing to me. So
totally.
Yeah, this is a guy that goes, again, very humble background. And, you know, when it comes to business school, he was doing well in a job. He was like trading, he was working on Wall Street. And he decides to go to Harvard Business School. And he goes 100% all in on Harvard Business. He suicides it, doesn't apply to anywhere else. Figures, you know, if I don't get in here, I'm just going to keep my job and keep doing what I'm doing. Goes to Harvard, gets hired from McKinley, like you said. And this is what I think is so interesting. And this is where, when we get into like the toxic aspects of Enron culture later, I think this shows why he really, really fit in there. So at that particular, it's a consulting firm. They hire people and they don't bring in people that like worked in IBM or a blue chip company and had a record of success. They tended to hire very, very, very young hotshots immediately out of school that had never worked at a company. And they wanted people with just esoteric, really brilliant ideas with accounting. They didn't want experience. They wanted people that kind of had this mystique of ideas. And that's really how they marketed their consultant firm. It's like the hottest place to go get these businesses. So it's not really a mystery why, when it comes to esoteric accounting practices and kind of a culture of hype, why this person from this consulting firm would then go to Enron and fit in so well.
Well, yeah. And would be able to carry that culture over. And I should say, you know, McKinsey is still considered like the best consulting firm, like of the top three or whatever. It's I think that every year when they do like what's the hardest interview you can do, like McKinsey is basically number one.
Yep.
And it has a good reputation for a lot of reasons, but you're right. Like its culture is very much one of like, we're going to give you the ideas. We're not going to execute
implement
this stuff.
Them. Yeah.
Right. Because they're a consulting firm. That's generally not what you do as a consulting firm. Some do it more than others, but that's not the point of that, right? Is you're supposed to say, we will write these papers, we will do this analysis, but we're not going to be the ones who get our hands dirty. That's fine if you're a consultant. Now, when you go to be, you know, the president of a company and lead things, that's when it becomes more problematic. When, as you say, you have these kind of esoteric, like academic kind of ideas, but you're not actually that interested or that capable of executing them. So mark-to-market accounting was the key to all of this. And I will say that one of the impacts of Enron was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is a piece of legislation that basically kind of increased you could be fined or even, you know, told you can't serve, you know, as a chief officer in a public company anymore, if you destroy or fabricate or you know, get rid of or make changes to records in your finances, or if you're doing anything that is kind of obstructing justice in a federal investigations of that sort of thing. And Sarbanes-Oxley is like a direct a descendant from Enron, and that's caught a bunch of companies. Including Apple. Apple got out of it, but you know, there have been a number of companies who have, over the years, been kind of burned or have had to change things because of that act. And Enron, interestingly, was kind of the portender of what was happening. Not like I think kind of across the industry. Enron was the big one, but then there was WorldCom, there was Tyco, there was Adelphia, there were all these other accounting scandals that kind of cropped up after the fact, and you kind of realized that this was just the beginning. And before we kind of get into the culture and some more about like what the scam was, what's interesting here is it was kind of a couple of levels. So you didn't just have the accounting fraud, but you also had people who were working in these different divisions of the company who were skimming off the top and making ridiculous amounts of money. And this is the part that to me is kind of like the part that still blows my mind. The company didn't care. It was one of those things where they were like, okay, so we'll hire these traders, these sales guys. And if they're ripping us off and they're taking some stuff off the top, fine, whatever, you know, do your thing. Just as long as our numbers, as our books look good for what we're trying to do, that's just a cost of doing business. So if somebody, if just like a, you know, a low-level trader or the CFO or people on their team, if they're just, you know, literally falsifying the records we're already falsifying so that they can have their own, you know, millions of take-home stuff, whatever.
That's absurd.
Yeah.
That like a, because you mentioned a few other scams as well, was that kind of an early 2000s attitude? Like, woo, because that was pre-2008 recession. So was that part of the attitude of, yeah, we're making so much money?
In fact, there was a story about the guy from McKinsey in college where they were asking, okay, let's say you're the CEO of a biotech company. And the product you're bringing to market, let's say there's strong evidence that this is hurting your patients. Do you keep bringing this to market or do you voluntarily recall it? And he said, you know what? I think it's the government's job to pull that off the market. It's not mine. That's someone else's. Now, I do want to stress, according to smartest guys in the room, he himself denies this. It's another classmate that eventually became a congressman who was in class with him that tells his story. But personally, I find that account very credible.
Yeah, I do too. And I mean, you know, like because one of the guys, the person who said it was a congressman, Jeff Skilling, got out of jail this year. So, you know, I'm just saying, like, who has more credibility? For me, it's going to be the guy who didn't go to jail for fraud. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's hard to say if this was like an early 2000s thing or if it had, or if it was just something that was discovered in the early 2000s, if that makes any sense. Like, because again, the timing about all of this was really kind of, I think, the market realities and the business realities of what happened in 2001, because it wasn't just September 11th, 2002, like that was a big part of it, but it was also the recession that happened post the dot-com boom and some of the other things. Like, I think that for a long period of time, like when I mean, we saw this with the financial crisis too, where when things are going well, it's really easy to hide all of the terrible stuff that businesses do. And it takes one falling, like Bear Stearns was, you know, the first bank to fall in 2008. And then it kind of precipitates after that, right? So it's, you know, to kind of bring others down. So I don't know if it was like a product of the time or if it was that we found out about it because as one ship fell, people started to investigate others. And it could have just been something that had been happening for decades. I don't actually know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like we have a couple threads to follow here. One being what actually happened with this scam, and the second being the culture of Enron, which Bree was talking about. As the ignorant person, what do you guys think we should pursue first?
Let's can we talk about the culture, and then Christina, you can follow the scam. Does that work?
Sure, sure.
So I, you know, there are
Bree, let me stop you right there. Yeah, I'm sure in an investment firm in the early 2000s, everything was great and hunky-dory and everyone respected each other. So
totally. And not just an and to be clear, Simone, it's not an investment firm. It is a Texas-based energy firm. It just happens to have investments as a side hustle.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
So totally everything hunky-dory in the energy business. There's never been the TV show Dallas was totally not about an oil company at all. Like, so, totally cool. Yeah.
So I think everyone listening to this today can kind of, you know, we're all geeks on the show, right? And I think when you're younger, it's kind of hard to accept yourself as a geek sometimes because you don't completely fit into the culture. At least I certainly didn't in Mississippi. There's a really dark side to Enron where a lot of the people we're talking about here were very geeky in high school. And then as they found themselves kind of at Enron, rather than like embracing this part of themselves, they went the other way and really created a culture of the company that I kind of hate the phrase toxic masculinity because I think it's one of these phrases that doesn't mean much sometimes. But here, I think it's very appropriate.
I mean, they were programmers before we had the term for programming, right?
Yeah, like, so yeah, there's a story that I thought was so great from Smartest Guys in the Room, where one of the people at Enron, a very high up person, goes and gets LASIK surgery, gets rid of the glasses. And immediately at Enron, immediately, everyone else goes and gets LASIK immediately. So no one at Enron is wearing glasses. And they have these trips down to Mexico where they're getting on motorbikes and ramping off hills and breaking bones and not following safety procedures. And it's kind of this culture where just being like accounting nerds was not enough. They were the most like gutsy, risk-taking. Like they talk in all these interviews, we love risk. We make money from risk. And there's this culture of machismo that wasn't just harmful to a lot of the women that worked in Enron, but it caused them to just take more and more aggressive risk. Yeah. And I think it was rooted in insecurity, if that makes sense. Yeah,
it totally was, because again, they're working in the most unsexy part of the, you know, they're working in natural gas. They're not working in oil, right? Like they don't have the cool commodity. You know, they are, even by energy standards, they are not that. These are people who, especially once Jeff Skilling joined, you know, they started to hire a bunch of Harvard MBAs. And in Houston and Texas, like that's not going to be, I mean, obviously you have that, but a lot of the traditional clients that you deal with are of a different type of generation and have a different sort of background. And to me, what always was interesting is you got this, like you read this, you had the reason that the book is called The Smartest Guys in the Room, and it's a great name for the book. There's also a documentary of the same name, which is equally fantastic. These were really smart people. But to me, it always kind of struck me, like you said, an insecurity thing. but also was like, these were, and they did have traders who worked in New York and whatnot, but these were a lot of people who it's like, they wanted to work on Wall Street. Like, that's what they wanted. And at the time, you have to keep in mind, like, this was when, again, before the 2008 crash, when it was really, like, that was the job you get if you're kind of a business bro, kind of, you know, having that machismo kind of thing. Like, that's where you go. And they were trying to kind of say, okay, we're even cooler than those guys. We're even more hardcore. But we're in the energy business, and we're in Houston, but we are more badass than you, right? Like, we are going to be the most badass, and we're going to be the most alpha male, and we're going to be the most, like, we're going to make the most money and take the most risk, and we're just going to be, oh, and we're smarter than you. And if you tell me that something doesn't make sense, I'm going to tell you you're a moron to go f*** yourself.
Wow.
Like, yeah. That was the whole kind of MO, and that was definitely the culture.
I have to put a little note in there because you done a swear.
I did do a swear. Christina. Sorry.
It's okay. Just because it's the bonus episode doesn't mean we can go around letting out our f's and our f's, Christina.
See, I thought that we could. All right. Well.
Maybe we can. I'll check with I'll check with Mike and Steven.
I think that rule is bullshit.
Wow. So. Thank you. I find it very, the idea of, I don't know, that like riding motorcycles and getting group LASIK surgery is so, that sounds like something that would happen in a movie.
Oh, totally. I mean, so much of this is, oh, there's this guy, he got off scot-free. He wasn't implicated in anything. He made like billions. His name is Lee Pai, and he...
love this guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. So this guy had a very significant, shall we say, interest in strippers. and not just like, oh, I like to go to the strip club as one does, but like, I'm going to spend tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of corporate money on the clubs. Like, I'm going to agree to go to an energy conference, but we're not going to go to the conference. We're going to get out of the limo from the airport, from our private jets, and we're going to go directly to the strip club. And that's what we're going to do. That was a whole thing too. And the kind of, again, kind of adds to that entire issue. Lupai is the guy's name. Yeah, he I believe owns like the largest, he owns some hugely significant part of, I believe it's Montana. He's like one of those guys who like owns most of the state. And did very well for himself. He sold almost 100, almost like a million shares in Enron before the collapse.
Wow.
Very well for himself.
Was that insider trading? This?
No. It's even better. This is so
okay,
good.
Okay, yeah, Simone. Tell the story.
This is the best story you're going to hear.
This guy's
today.
So good.
Okay. It sounds like it's something you would write in a bad romance novel. I swear to God, this is true.
Yes, give me the material.
So, okay, like Christina said, he spent a lot of, like, I just want to underline, I think all of us on the show are sex-positive feminists. If
Completely.
You are a stripper, I think that's a noble profession. You should do that. I'm not going to judge you.
Hell no.
So the men that worked at Enron, they were like, how does your wife not, like, smell all the stripper's perfume?
Yes.
How does she not notice this? He goes, well, I've got this trick. So on my way home from the strip club, I go to the gas station and I just get a little bit of gas and I pour it on myself.
Not
going to smell that. And then later, the whole reason that he got away with all this money in a way that was plausibly legal, it was $250 million, is he had to liquidate and sell all of his stock because his wife found out about these multiple affairs and divorced him. Yeah.
Well, the reason she divorced him is because he wasn't just having an affair with a stripper who was also married. She got pregnant.
Pregnant with his child.
So the wife is like, they've been married for 20 years and she's like, oh, I'm divorced you and you know they didn't have a prenup, and so she's gonna get half, so he has to liquidate all of his assets. He has to sell that stock. And so then he ended up, you know what, but good for him, he and the stripper got married, and I believe they still are married.
That's amazing.
I'm sure it worked out. I'm sure it's very happy. What a happy story, Simone.
No, that's truly incredible. I hope that they're actually really happy.
I mean, that's
together.
The thing. I mean, honestly, me too. But this is the thing. Like, this is a guy who, because he ran the trading floor, and he would fight with some other people at the in the business about, you know, territory and whatnot. And he was by his own admission, Lu Pai was like, I only care about the money. Give me the. He cared about the money and the strippers. That was it. And I have to kind of give him a little bit of a pat on the back for not ever pretending to be anything other than he like was. Mm-hmm. Like just straight out honest, being like, I only care about the money and the strippers.
That's great.
You know what? I kind of respect like that, like the lack of BS involved in that. But because of that, like he was always fighting over every little thing regarding who would get credit, who would get money, what the, you know, the breakdown of bonuses would be. And the people who worked for him really liked him because he was very greedy by his own admission, would be greedy for them too. And but again, like Bree said, like he got basically away with all this stuff. It's not clear, like, okay, from my perspective, and I'm going to be very careful here because this guy has more money than God and be litigious. Not that he'll ever hear this podcast, but I don't want to.
We're not whatever. Tempting fate.
There wasn't any proof in anything that basically said that he was involved, and he wasn't charged. He was investigated, but he wasn't charged with anything. But it seems to me that it would be odd that someone who the book refers to him as the invisible CEO and who was responsible for so much money and so many things that the company did, it would be odd if he was completely unaware.
Yep.
Now, obviously mm-hmm. that's possible, but it would be odd if he were. In any event, he and Rebecca Mark were the two that were basically the smartest in all this because they got out of this before yep. it all went downhill. And so, you know, cool. Like, again, I my love of scammers is kind of the thing. It's like, if you're able to get out of it and
yeah.
have clean hands, even if they're not really clean, I kind of can't hate you. I know I should. I
think
I know
it
I
is
should,
a factor because
can't.
When we look at stuff like Fyre Festival, it was just a fool digging a deeper and deeper hole for himself. And it's like, you didn't need to do that. You could have just done your scam and then gotten away. But no, you kept trying to pretend it was a real thing. And that's where you get messed up. Which, to be fair, does apply to right. Anna Delvey too. But then she was also so extra. And also,
well, that's the thing with her. Like, she's
like 50
she's
people
a bad,
she, on an island.
Well, she's a bad, like she's a bad scammer. But she's an amazing person. Like, that's the thing with her.
Christina Kitt, okay. Just, side tangent, just really quickly before we get into what the scam was. Have you looked into getting visitation rights to see her in jail?
Oh my God. That
oh
is
my
a
God,
great
I should.
Idea.
That is a fantastic
can you actually,
idea.
Can you interview
that should be
her?
Our bonus episode.
I'm sorry,
Christina
yeah.
goes to jail.
Shoot, like. Cancel this. Okay, stop recording. We got a new idea. Okay. We'll look into that.
Stay tuned for next year, Rocket.
Yeah, for
listeners.
Next year. Christina yes. goes to jail
Christina
to interview Anna Delvey and Fangirl. Yeah, no. And be clear, when
Seattle
I say it,
for this, just for the yeah, record, okay?
Without a doubt. And to be clear, when I say amazing, I don't mean as in like she's like a spectacular. Well, I do, but I mean it like in the, not in like that she's a great person, but in she's like really like, wow, you know?
We don't endorse her. We're just saying we would all fly to Seattle to go visit her in jail.
We
and
don't
talk
endorse
about it and
her.
It. Yeah.
We're just mad
right.
that
we don't
Christina didn't think of it first.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Christina. Yeah. Christina, tell
no,
me
and,
about...
And honestly...
Okay, go on.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if I would hope that I would be the Lu Pai in an Anna Delvey situation, is all I'm trying to
we
say.
Know
like,
that
I would hope
would.
That I would be...
We trust you. Now tell me about the scam.
Okay. So the scam, again, it comes down to this mark-to-market accounting stuff where they are able to get credit for deals that they sign, whether the moment those deals are signed, whether you know they've basically received all that money or not. Now, again, how this is supposed to work is that if the values of those things changes, either goes up or down, you are supposed to make revisions to your books, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to kind of keep it up to date and say, okay, we recognize $20 million in revenue, but there was an issue and maybe the value of this now is worth $17 million and we have to adjust things accordingly, or now the value is higher and we have to adjust things accordingly. Enron didn't do that. They basically just said, okay, the minute we sign this deal, no matter how plausible it is, no matter how likely it is for this to happen. And a lot of times these deals would be for things that nobody had ever thought of before. So for instance, if they would sign, they would create, you know, make a deal with a city to say, we are going to provide you with natural gas, again, for let's say a 20 million, for like a 20-year period, and it will have an ultimate value of, again, let's just say like $20 million or whatever. Mm-hmm. No one had up to this point, because Enron was really born out of deregulation. That was one of Ken Lay's really big things that he was really harping on from the before he even joined the company that later became Enron. Like, he really thought that the deregulated natural gas industry would lead to opportunities for people to make money. And so this was in the 80s when the Reagan administration was just like deregulation like crazy. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, side note, I think as we've seen, deregulation really hasn't wound up being like the harbinger that a lot of people thought. But at the time, this was especially for the finance types and the, you know, bean counters, people were like, oh, we can find a way to make money here. Up until the 80s, the way the natural gas worked was that the price was set by the government, and it was a pretty boring kind of business where, you know, the people who need it buy it at a certain rate, and that's set by the government, and that's that. When it became deregulated, then, you know, you could sell things for more or less depending on what you were doing. And additionally, Enron started to say, okay, well, we should also look at doing natural gas pipelines in other parts of the world to make investments in other parts of the world who might be wanting to get off of coal or going into other, you know, alternative energy sources, and we can make bets there. So one of the things that they would do is that they would say, okay, we need to guess what the price of gas is going to be in the future over the course of this deal. And we need to set the price of this. We need to model out and say, what price can we set that will give us enough cushion to A, make a profit off of what we're able to buy it at? Because they didn't actually have the gas most of the time when they were making these deals. If a company, like if a you know, a city or whoever came to them and said, we need gas, this much gas for this period of time, in most cases, Enron didn't actually have the gas. So what they would have to do is they would have to go on the open market itself. They'd have to buy that gas at a certain price. Oh, and then they would need to figure out a price to sell it to the customer where they're still able to make the money. The problem is that if you don't do that exactly right, you could be left holding the bag if the price goes, you know, too high or too low. Or if the customer decides not to pay, which happened in some other international deals. This is why the mark-to-market accounting thing never should have been allowed for these types of Enron deals. And this was all Jeff Skilling's business. And they never should have been allowed to do this, because you're having to model things out over many years when there weren't projections for what those things would be, and when what they were taking into account when they were predicting the prices didn't take into account, okay, what if we have to, you know, build out a plant? What if there are problems with that? What if something happens with the supplier? What if something happens with the client? What if, you know, something ends early? They didn't account for any of that. They basically just did like a best case scenario and then honestly kind of a guess as what the price would be. And then
I give an example of this?
They lost
$1 billion in very high risk investments in building energy refineries in India. No one else would do this. And Enron looked at that risk and said, giddy up, let's go. And then they built it. And then no one in India could afford the energy they were refining.
Oh my God.
So they lost over $1 billion on that deal.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. No, yeah, totally. And that was a Rebecca Marks business. That was not Jeff Skilling's, but she was also using mark-to-market accounting, the same type of thing. And so exactly, like they would make these types of deals without having any like real reason to know what it could come out to be. And Arthur Andersen, this is why Arthur Andersen went down, signed off on all of this. So you have the number one accounting firm in the world, some of, you know, like the people who are supposed to be making sure that their clients are following the laws and are following procedures, who basically were convinced, okay, fine, we'll do this, and these books are accurate. But then they didn't go back and make sure, hey, should we be updating the values of these investments? No, they didn't do that. And in some cases, you would have thought, oh, well, if we've lost money on this deal, then we could write this off as like a tax thing, right? So we can put this off as a liability, and that might be good for us. But they didn't do that. They kept it on the books as an asset. They didn't make any changes, and they would just record new deals they would sell, again, the minute they happen. So the whole thing ends up being, like, you know, kind of just a complete fraud. You have no idea how much anything is worth. And then on top of that, like I said before, you have people at all levels of the company who are just skimming off, you know,
yeah,
money
just a little
from these
here
deals
and there
for their own bonuses.
On top of the millions of dollars of fake money.
Right. Right.
What a cluster muff.
And then my favorite scenario is that they got really good at, you know, in some cases, there were hard assets and things they really were doing. Like, they lost $1 billion on the NDA deal, but you could at least say, look, they were building an actual pipeline. They built an actual, like, you know, natural gas, you know, like, a setup, right? Like, they had an energy station. They were doing real things. It was risky, and it lost them a lot of money, and it was, and, you know, the accounting stuff on it was shady. But that was a real thing they were doing. Whereas in some cases, it was just pure speculation trading. And then what they did is they had this brilliant idea. And in 2000, where broadband started to kind of take off, and they decided this is my favorite thing in the entire world. This is my favorite thing in the entire world. So, you know, the internet is you know, mainstream internet is 5-6 years old at this point, and broadband starts to take off, and so they start to say, well, you know, we've been selling natural gas as, you know, a speculative kind of commodity thing, and we've been doing the trading there, and then finding places to buy it, sell it, whatnot. Why can't we just do that with broadband? Why can't we just sell broadband to people at speculative rates? And so they started to sell broadband. Now, keep in mind that broadband doesn't work the way that like natural gas works.
Oh, no.
And you don't have like one provider, you know, of all the broadband. But they went on the market and were like, yo, yeah, we're going to have a broadband trading thing. And people bought into it. People were like, oh, yeah, we'll sign up and we'll get this rate for this amount of broadband. And then they had no way to deliver it, no way to track it. You know, like, it's one of those things. It'd be like now, when I was rereading the book, and I haven't read the book in a number of years, and it's one of my favorite books ever. I was thinking to myself, I was like, today, if this were to be done, rather than broadband, it would be cloud computing power. Ignoring the fact that selling a unit of cloud computing, you can't do, because you have a bunch of public clouds, but they are not interchangeable. So you can't say to a client, oh, well, the price of AWS is this, and the price of Azure, a disclosure, that's where I work, is this, and the price of Google Cloud is this. They're not interchangeable because they work in different ways. It's not, I mean, you know, like, it's becoming more commoditized, and people, you know, some people have multi-cloud scenarios, but it's not the same thing. So you wouldn't be able to just say to somebody, oh, well, since the spot price, you know, on AWS is this, we'll just give you this amount of, you know, like, cloud computing units, and that's completely going to work with your infrastructure. Like, that's not how that works. But that's what they were trying to do with broadband, which is hilarious.
That's absolutely nuts. Wow. So how did they get found out?
This is what's really interesting. This is kind of great. Yep. So Bethany McLean, who was a reporter at Fortune, mm-hmm. she was previously a trader one of the big banks. And then she was at Fortune, and she'd been there for a couple of years. She got a tip from someone who said, hey, Enron's money, their figures kind of don't make sense. And so she looked into it, and she was like, huh, you're right. How are they making money? This doesn't make sense to me.
Huh.
So she starts asking questions. And Enron got really mad. Like, they got super, super, super mad. They were like, how dare you question us? And how dare you do these things? And we'll invite you and your editors and your people over to come, you know, see what we've done. And then they don't answer any of her questions. They talk in circles. Andy Fastow, who was the CFO, he also went to jail. And look, he was involved. He was mostly, in my opinion, like, his biggest, like, con was that he, like, scraped money off the top. He was in, if we're going to be talking about people just following orders, he was not the brains of this operation. The two brains were Kenley and Jeff Skilling, but I digress. But, you know, she meets with these people and she's asking them all these questions and they're not giving her any specific answers.
Wow.
So in April of 2001, she writes, frankly, a pretty short article that just raises a bunch of questions and says, I don't know how this is making money. This does not make sense to me. It didn't really have any impact. And this stock, I think it was probably published around its all-time high. And then into that summer is when there was tumult at the company. And Jeff Skilling left, and Lou Pye sold his stock because he got the stripper
got out of there. And Rebecca
Rebecca Marks, who was the only like woman in power in Enron, she also left. She had run Enron International, so she was the one who was responsible for that $1 billion failure in India. They all leave. Ken Lay comes back as CEO. And now, again, with like the weird, you know, the climate happening economically in the country, people start to look at things more closely. At this point, what happens is that the stock drops below a point where the company can cover up the losses.
Oh, no.
So when the stock was above a certain place, they could continue to paper over those losses and paper over the fact that the accounting was completely fraudulent. And all they really wanted to do was keep the stock up. As long as the stock is up at a certain thing, everything's fine. If it goes below a certain point, then at this point, they're not going to genuinely have enough money to make up good on the deals and to be responsible for what they've said they will. At this point, too, because of the financial things, especially after September 11th, it's harder for them to, you know, get funding from banks and loans and things like that. So when that starts to happen, then the company is in trouble, and they're talking about like they report their earnings and they're saying, hey, this is not good. And then it moves very, very quickly. And mm-hmm. at that point, people start to look back at McLean's article and start to hone in and say, wait a minute, what have we been missing? and that kind of helped kickstart the investigation that really coincided with them filing for bankruptcy in December 2001. So similar to Theranos, it was a reporter asking questions that really helped unravel all of this. And McLean is one of the co-authors of The Smartest Guys in the Room. And she's now a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. She's fantastic. And I love that, like, Jeff Skilling, who called himself so smart and thought that she was just an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, sucks to be you, Jeff.
So I really, you know, we're huge fans of scams on the show as far as covering them. But, you know, one of the things is if you're covering Anna Delvey,
yeah.
Yeah. If you're covering her, you know, a hotel was charged for some rooms for a while, and a couple of people had some money taken from them, right? Like the stakes are serious. It affected people. The stakes are lower there. In this case, the thing that really makes this entire thing unforgivable and why, frankly, more people should have gone to jail is Ken mm-hmm. Lay and the Enron board, at the same time, they're reassuring the public, everything's fine. Don't worry about this. Our accounting's there. We're going to work all this out. Don't lose confidence. They're bringing the same kind of hyper machismo confidence to the situation at the same time that they are cashing out their stocks.
Yep. They are literally selling everything they've got. They're liquidating
everything. And so not only are they harming the people whose pensions were there, not only are they defrauding investors, but they're profiting at the expense of other people. They're buying this worthless stock because they're lying about it. So I think this, to this day, this is why, you know, this is why when you watch Mr. Robot and you see the E Corp logo, it's a barely hidden take on Enron.
Yeah.
Because when you're thinking about corporate greed and frankly, a lack of ethics, this is really one of the best examples in modern American history.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. And actually, I'm going to put this in our chat so that you can link to it, Simone, for anybody who wants. I bought this shirt. This shirt came out recently. My favorite brand of vaporwave aesthetic clothing is called Public Space. And they made a shirt that is the Enron logo, but says fire instead of Enron.
Oh my God, I love this.
And you own this shirt and you've worn it on your show, right?
I sure have. I've worn this on my YouTube show. It's so good. So Rand Paul, the famed designer who designed the Next logo and other things, he designed the Enron logo. And
wait, his name
you know,
is
that,
Rand Paul?
Paul Rand.
Paul Rand. Wow. Okay.
Sorry. That was,
yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Brain blip.
Yeah, no, Paul, Yeah, Paul Rand, excuse me, Paul Rand, who's great, not Rand Paul, who's not. Paul Rand designed the logo, but Paul Rand also designed the Next logo and a bunch of other very famous logo designs. But yeah, I love that fire by Enron. Oh my God,
this whole site is awesome, Christina. Wow.
I know. I own like a significant amount of things off the site. I have the Gucci Game Boy shirt.
Oh, wow.
I have the Zelda shirt. There's a shirt that says Apple 95 that is the Apple logo crossed with the Windows 95 logo.
That's beautiful. Oh my God.
It is. I actually kind of want to get that as a tattoo. Anyway,
I'm sending this to our commerce writer right now, but go on.
Yeah, exactly. It's the greatest site ever. But anyway, but yeah, exactly. Like this is... yeah, as Bree was saying, like this took down so many people, and then the executives and the board members, you know, they gave this all a pass, and very few people went to jail for this. I mean, Jeff Skilling went to jail. Ken Lay died before he could go to jail. Andy Fastow, who was the CFO, went to jail, and that was basically it. Henry Kissinger, who was also on the Theranos board, was on the Enron board. You know, I mean, there were people who didn't do these things. And the one thing we didn't talk about, one of the other ways they hid this, just because we didn't have time, but it's really complicated, is that, and this is why it's worth reading the book, is they created these special purpose and entities. And so they would create these little companies, basically, for certain projects as yet another way to hide the accounting fraud. And this was a thing that Andy Fastow really liked to do. And so they were basically just shell companies that were created for a specific project designed in a way to hide more of what they were doing so that A, you could skim off the top, and B, you could, hide your fraud, make it more easy to do. And that was, I think, one of the reasons why this took so long to catch, is that Bethany McLean said that when she was looking through their books and trying to do the research, you know, and this is somebody who wasn't just a reporter, but had like a finance background, it was some of the most complicated, filings that she'd ever seen. Like even if you're a regular investor, even if you think that you're doing your due diligence, if you look at what they're trying to say, like it's so complicated and it has so many different layers that it's almost impossible to understand. So a lot of people are just going to go by the top level stuff and say, oh, okay, well, this is basically in line with the Standard & Poor's index and it's, you know, growing sequentially. It's not like it's, you know, making these hand over fist profits that are, you know, out of line of what the rest of the industry is doing. I think this is fine. And I think that's part of why they got away with it for so long.
Wow. This is so interesting and juicy. And you said the book that you referenced was The Smartest Guys in the Room.
Yep. Great. Yep. It's excellent.
And there's a documentary about that too, right?
There sure is. It won the Academy Award.
Yeah.
The guy who directed it is the same guy who directed the Theranos documentary for HBO.
Excellent. I would like to contribute some knowledge that I just received from Wikipedia, which is that Luke Pye, immediately after like the whole thing, moved with his wife to Canaan Ranch, where they raised and trained dressage horses. They do not do that anymore, but they did for a while. And that means something to me.
Rich people and their horses, man. I love it.
I know. It's so good. All right. Well, thank you, guys. This is a really great first episode of Scam Town, and I hope we can do it again sometime. And of course, our regular podcast is Rocket, which you can find on Relay FM and wherever podcasts are distributed. Christina, where can we find you online?
So you can find me at Scam... No, I'm kidding. You can find me at film_girl on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can find the stuff that I do at work, where I'm sadly not talking about scams, but I usually am wearing scam-related merch, or at least really cool Vaporwave merch, at youtube.com/Microsoft Developer.
And Brianna, what about you?
Next week, you can find me at the New York Times print edition.
Yes!
So, which I need to get back to my
I'm
deadline
so
on
proud
today.
Of you.
I didn't
so
well, proud of for you. Horrible stuff, but yay. Yeah. Anyway, 5-year anniversary of Gamergate. Great reason to be in the Times. You can find me on Twitter and under Brianna Wu, and you can see me on the Facebook machine at developer Brianna Wu.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at DoomQuasar and on YouTube .com/Polygon. I wasn't sure if I was just going to say on YouTube at youtube.com or if I was going to say the URL, which is what I ended up doing. Hey, thank you so much, everyone. And thank you also for being a Relay FM member. That's really cool. It helps a bunch of really great podcasts exist. Ours is just one of those many, many, many podcasts, which you are probably familiar with. But if you want a refresher about what they do, Relay.fm. And thank you. Thank you so much for being a member. I hope that you enjoy our bonus episode the most, more than anyone else's, because it is a competition.
Yeah, it is. And seriously, thank you for listening to us. Thank you for being a member of Relay. And thank you to Mike and Steven and everybody at the Relay team for letting us do this show for going on 5 years now. We are
that's ridiculous.
We've been able to do this and that we get to talk to all of you every week about not just tech, but scams and pop culture and games. Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, Left Shark. Like,
oh, wow.
It's great.
Deep cut, deep cut. All right. We've
combined tech and Tay into take. Both
of them together. And on that beautiful note, this episode of Rocket is terminated.
Terminated.
Terminated.